The Source Podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. The constant action, bright colors, intense music, and dramatic sound effects. It's no wonder that video games are so popular. But are they getting too popular for some, to the point of an addiction? Gaming disorder is now being recognized by the World Health Organization, but what does that mean? And just because someone plays a lot of games, does that mean they are addicted? And even if they're not, do they still have a problem? Or is this just another example of one part of the culture not understanding video game culture and blaming it for something, just fill in the blank? Call in with your questions and comments as we talk about gaming disorder. The number is 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet at us at tprsource. Is there someone in your family that you think plays a lot of video games to the point where it has become a problem? Are they addicted? Give us a call, 210-614-8980. With us today to talk about that, Dr. Anthony Bean, clinical psychologist, video game researcher, executive director at the Telso Project. Dr. Bean, welcome to The Source.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And Dr. Kelly Dunlop is here, doctor of psychology, game developer, and director of mental health research and design at iThrive Games. Dr. Dunlop, hi.
Hello.
Let me ask you first, Dr. Dunlop, do you believe that there is such a thing as a gaming disorder, and is it widespread?
Well, that's a difficult question. So I do believe that people can play games in a way that can be problematic, and that can be played to excess. Now, whether or not that is because of the game, I have not seen research that really supports that at this point. So, I guess in one way, yes, you can game to an excessive extent that can be problematic, but whether it's an actual disorder in its own right, unique from anything else, I don't think so.
Well, help us understand that distinction. When we say it is an addiction, how is that different from it just being a problem?
So one of the issues is that we like to take terms that we use in psychology that have a very specific clinical meaning and adopt them into common parlance. For example, I'm so addicted to Netflix. I'm addicted to my phone. I'm binge watching a show. And so we take these terms and we apply them into our everyday parlance. And so we think we know what they mean, but you know, when we're talking about addiction, we're talking about somebody who is going through like withdrawals and having a biological and physiological reaction. We're talking about people who are not enjoying the activity that they're engaging in. And I really do think that that is one of the hallmarks that we should be paying attention to when we're trying to distinguish between somebody who is just really into games and really passionate and enjoying their pastime, their career, versus somebody who is doing something because it doesn't bring them joy anymore, but they feel compelled to continue doing it, even though it doesn't bring them joy.
And Dr. Bean, what are your thoughts?
I actually concur with Kelly on this, Dr. Dunlap, and I believe that what we're kind of seeing is a bit of a cultural phenomenon happening, and we've seen it over time if we look through history with Dungeons and Dragons, with pinball machines, with comic books, with dime magazines in the 60s and 70s. And what we're kind of watching the evolution of what we call a moral panic on this, of not understanding the video game culture. And the reason I think it is because it's come up so fast. One of the aspects of this culture is it started in the 1980s, mid-80s, but it didn't really gain traction until probably about, I'd say about a decade ago, when we started seeing a lot more ability to have these consoles and these games in your homes, in not just in arcades. People are able to get them really, really easy. And when we deal with parents who may or may not understand what's going on with their child or what they're getting from it, it's really coming down to that they don't understand the video game culture. and they don't really kind of understand what's actually happening, because they didn't grow up in it, and that's not their fault, but it is our duty as parents, I think, to really understand what's gravitating our children towards these types of different nuances of life.
So we can endeavor to talk about that this afternoon and have an exchange about video games and what's the appropriate amount to play. But people also need to be aware of how video games, as you're a video game researcher, Dr. Bean, and Dr. Dunlop, you work for iThrive Games. Y'all are very familiar that these games are designed in a very specific way to capture the player and keep them engaged as long as possible. I mean, is that not correct, Dr. Dunlop?
I mean, I guess capture is an interesting word. I mean, yes, games are absolutely designed, and they are designed to give you an experience that is engaging, oftentimes enjoyable, but also challenging and difficult. You know, games are a way for us to experience the full range of human emotions. Like, you know, you can play a game and you can feel shame and guilt and sadness and grief, as well as joy and excitement and like those Fiero moments where like, I did the thing. And so they're very powerful in that they connect with us at a very basic level of getting human needs met. So, you know, one of the reasons that games are so engaging is not because of the flashing lights and colors and the gamification parts, like the stars and things like that. It's that you're given a problem that you can achieve, and you know that there has to be a solution. You can't fail at a game unless you give up. This is very, very different than the world that we live in as adults and even as children, where it's not like you don't get out what you put in necessarily. Where in a game, you can do the thing, and it's designed for you to succeed. Those really important senses of competency. The common term for this is self-determination theory, that kind of sketches out with games so much. So it's not that they're designed, they're not Skinner boxes, they're not intentionally designed to hook us in the sense of like, we want you to stare at our screen the entire time and never move. But it's more about the experience of, especially in video games, the experience of storytelling, of achievement, of the hero's journey, of experiencing just different artistic expressions of the human experience.
Yeah, but when you say that, when you can feel the full range of emotions by playing video games, including sadness and shame, does that mean like when you skip a day of going to school so that you sit down and play your game all day long, is that when those emotions kick in?
No, I was referring more to, you know, if you play a game like The Last of Us or The Walking Dead. These are games where you have to make decisions as the player, and they're very difficult ethical, moral decisions within that game universe. And it's not uncommon for people who play games to go, man, I really felt guilty about having to make that decision. Or I felt really sad when this character died or this thing happened. So it's more of being able to evoke those kinds of feelings that we tend to avoid outside of games, but that it's healthy for us to experience and observe and process. So that's what I meant by like shame and guilt.
Okay, so we're going to take a break and we'll take some callers. The phone line is 210-614-8980. What are your gaming habits? Have you ever felt that you were losing control of your life because you felt like you had to keep playing the game? Or does it just so compelling? These stories are so rich and the content is so overwhelming that you just have a hard time putting down that controller. And before you know it, the day's over, the night's over, and up comes the sun and you've been playing a game all night long. How does that work? 210-614-8980 is the number to call. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Chances somewhere in your house you probably have a PlayStation or an Xbox or some Nintendo device. These are high technology devices. They're incredible. They are able to provide this incredible entertainment experience. You go to other worlds and inhabit these strange planets and go on these adventures. They follow these characters on tremendous quest, and they're very compelling, and they're a lot of fun. But what happens when people stop going to school or stop going to work or ignoring other things in order to play these games to a higher level? And when does that become a gaming disorder? Their number to call in is 210-614-8980. And James is on the line. And James, welcome to The Source. James, you're on the air.
Thank you, David. I enjoy your show. It's interesting topics all the time.
Thank you.
Anyway, I was wondering if there's any correlation between the intense games that you play on television. I used to play Doom, Serious Sam, and some others that were first-person shooters. I wonder if there's any correlation between those games and the intensity and some of the violence that we see. For instance, the guy that was outside the courthouse, there was never any explanation as to why he came to the courthouse and shot the bullets into the courthouse. So I was just curious.
That's the fellow in Dallas that happened just the other day you're referring to.
That's correct.
All right, James, thank you for that. So let me go to Dr. Anthony Bean, clinical psychologist, video game researcher. For a long time, people have tried to make a connection between video game playing and violence. And what does the research tell us?
The research actually culminated in the Brown versus EMA, I believe it was 2011, and the Supreme Court even struck it down, saying that there wasn't enough evidence to support that conclusion, and that a lot of people who are trying to push that conclusion, it's not just with video games, it's with any sort of violent social media or movies or anything along those lines, have actually been shown to bias their research a little heavier than the normal, cherry pick their data and only show conclusions to what helps inform their ending, I guess is the easiest way to results to do that. To give you an idea, when we go and look at all of the shooters that have happened across the United States, Sandy Hook, Columbine, all of these people, the first thing that does media likes to usually grab onto is, oh my gosh, they were playing video games. But we don't know what games they were always playing in that moment. And you can go and actually look up and see the reports of all the games that these shooters have actually played in the past. And 9 times out of 10, and I'm going to do that one because I haven't seen one yet that hasn't had a shooter game as the primary game being played. But most of the time, they're playing nonviolent games. And the active games that they are playing don't have that violent aspect with it, so it can't necessarily carry over, I guess is the easiest way to put it. And that games are the idea that games train people to shoot and cause violence and cause aggression, I think is very, very, very unsubstantiated.
Dr. Dunlop, in your research as a doctor of psychology and game developer and director of mental health research at iThrive Games, there's been a lot of research that says that actually can have the opposite effect, that people who play games, it can help them release some of their violent pent-up energy that they have. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about video games as just being a form of, you know, a form of de-stress, of relaxation. I mean, if you go out and you play football, like sometimes people go out and, you know, punching bags or play sports that are something that's very physical. And it's a method of exertion, of getting out the stress of the day, because we know that it's very unhealthy to hold that in. And so for the most part, when people come home to play games, some of them involve explosions and some of them involve solving puzzles. But it's this idea that we can do something where we can just like enter that flow state, that state of play, where we get to relax, we kind of get to put down the burdens of the day and just enjoy the moment of what we're doing. And that can be very beneficial.
Yeah, they can be playing Madden football. That's like, you know, that's a football game. It's a video game, but is that something that's going to be a violent game? I don't think so. Let's go to another caller. This is Jerry. And Jerry, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to speak on the mental health side. Speaking from experience, I feel that sometimes these games can help enable some of us with mental health issues to neglect our care, neglect our treatment, or neglect seeking some kind of proper treatment plan for our issues. And when you play a video game, especially those open world games where there's tons of things you can do, it's easy to waste hours and hours and just lose yourself in this game versus, you know, instead of looking at yourself in the mirror and saying, okay, I need to address these issues. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It speaks to me, Jerry. I appreciate that. You feel like you are actually accomplishing something, and these games really try to reinforce that. So Dr. Kelly Dunlop, what would you say to Jerry?
I think there's a lot of important threads that Jerry is pulling on. So one is this idea of losing yourself in the game. And to an extent, that is totally fine. You know, people lose themselves in books, but we don't freak out about that. You know, if someone was sitting and playing and reading a book for several hours a day, you know, as long as they're still accomplishing the things they need to get done in life, like they're still going to school or maintaining their grades, they're going to work, doing those basic things and functioning, then we don't see it as a problem. In terms of using games as an escape, which is a different thing, like you're actively avoiding your problems, that can be problematic, just kind of by definition. And those are the kind of things that you want to look for if you are worried about somebody who's playing video games. Are they doing it because they enjoy it and it's relaxation, and they're using it to actually benefit their mental health? Or are they doing it to avoid issues that are going on with their life or possibly cope with them? That's definitely been my experience working with individuals who feel like they have a problem with gaming, or that they're gaming too much, is that the game is serving some purpose, fulfilling some purpose for them in their life that their physical world is not fulfilling. So whether that's social connection with others, like in World of Warcraft, there's people there, you work with your guilds and you accomplish these amazing quests and people rely on you. And if you're not getting that kind of social need met, let's say in the real world, it can be very alluring, but it's not because it's addictive. It's not, you know, nicotine in your system. It's a way for you to get needs met that, you know, if you're not aware and cognizant of that, may become problematic.
Dr. Anthony Bean, as we talk about video games as a way to spend your time, if you're enjoying your time, then you're not wasting your time. I think, you know, people deserve to have some, you know, enjoyment. But when does it become to a point where you've lost control?
We tend to see it when they come in for a therapeutic session, when other areas of their life are being avoided or not being completed, such as the work habits are happening, family life is not being taken into consideration, the inability to shower or manage your hygiene, also known as activities of daily living. Things happen, we start to ask the question is, well, you know, what's happening? Why are we forgetting to do these things? Is there a time that the game is asking you to say, hey, you know, let's take a quick little break so you can get these other things done? Or is your family actually out of town that week and you're just going to binge on that type of game because you're like, man, I haven't had this chance since I was in undergrad or in high school to go and really enjoy myself in this capacity? And I think that the games themselves, to reiterate what Kelly was saying, was very much on that when you are enjoying yourself, you're getting a sense of purpose from it. And when you get that sense of purpose, it's harder to put it down in that capacity, especially when you're not getting it from your real life. Because I think we can all agree that real life sometimes is not the easiest way to live. And there are tons of problems that come up. And when we feel like we accomplished something, when we feel like we are understanding and getting that push to be a better person on some level, that's when we are feeling like we need to keep on playing. But healthy boundaries are always very, very important. And that's really the number one thing we work with families up here in Fort Worth.
So Luis on Twitter, he wrote to us saying gaming used to be healthy, but after the smartphone revolution, gaming should be handled like gambling or alcohol because they are designed to make you pay as you play. You can end up spending hundreds or thousands of dollars. And Bonnie is on the line. I think she's got a similar point. Bonnie, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering about the, it sounds like a parallel to a gambling problem, where we see, you know, physical manifestations during play and as withdrawal from play, because every thought you have is actually a neurochemical reaction. So our brains, the brains come into this.
Correct.
And the other thing I wanted to ask about is young children, my grandchildren, you know, ages 3 and 6 are being addicted to their tablets.
All right. Thank you for those 2 points. Let's go to the gambling thing first. And so, Callie Dunlap, Dr. Dunlap, is there some sort of similarities between gambling disorder and gaming disorder?
Well, I think the way the ICD-11, the World Health Organization's diagnostic manual would say yes, because they have listed gaming disorder under an addictive disorder. And gaming disorder, or rather gambling disorder, as we know it in the U.S. using the American version, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM, it recently shifted gambling from an impulse control disorder to an addictive disorder. So I guess by like the rules as they're written, you could say yes, they're in the same family. But that is pretty contentious by us in the field. So for example, you know, gambling is something where you put something in, there's no guarantee of you getting something in return. It operates extensively on a very specific kind of reward schedule that is known to be the most effective at prolonging whatever behavior you're doing. So if you're thinking about, you know, pulling that lever, you know, maybe next time, maybe next time, maybe next time. And so that's kind of how gambling is constructed. Games in general are not constructed that way.
Well, the loot drops are considered to be very close to gambling.
So yeah, so there are mechanics in games that can reflect that. And there are certain things that games do. So games as a whole, no. But there are certain aspects. So you mentioned loot boxes. And that is an area that is super fascinating. It is obviously blowing up right now. There's a lot of conversation around it. And it is one of the things that it looks like gambling. It may feel like gambling, but the research on loot boxes in general, especially the many, many different kinds of loot boxes, like it's so nascent, it's so new that you can't really say anything with any kind of scientific or empirical underpinnings at this point. And so what I tend to feel is that I think the game developers should not just try to walk the letter of the law in terms of it's not gambling because of this specific terminology, but I would love to see them do better. So I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with loot boxes in general, but I do think that there should be some more transparency from the game companies and the creators around things like how much money have you spent and, you know, what is your chance of getting a specific drop that has a rare item in it versus not. And so I do think they can do better in giving informed consent to the players who are engaging in those mechanics of the game.
We're talking about a gaming disorder. That is a classification, a very serious classification that the World Health Organization has come up with for folks who are addicted to gaming. Addiction is a very high level. Only 60% of the people who play video games regularly actually play every day, and only 3% of the people who play at that level are actually considered to be possibly addicted, would qualify for gaming disorder. But is there still a level of gaming that may or may not be healthy? When do we know that it's time for someone to put the controller down and start living real life? And when you say, you know, there is still, you're putting your time into the gaming, and your time does have some value, and there is that opportunity cost, things that you're not doing because you're playing so much gaming. What to do about that? What does it look like in your family, in your house? The number to call in is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The source continues right after this quick break.
Immigration.
I think we need to all get in before the wall goes up.
Health.
The Promotora, they have all the resources that can get them the help that they need.
Art.
There's this kind of subversiveness to it, right?
We cover all these topics and more on Fronteras as we examine issues along the border and beyond. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras where you find your favorite podcasts.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Is video game addiction similar to a substance addiction or gambling addiction? What would treatment look like? We're talking about gaming disorder. This is a classification that the World Health Organization has now embraced for people who are playing games, electronic gaming, to a point of exclusion of other things, where they don't go to work, they don't go to school, they don't shower, they have sleep deprivation. This is not a good place to be, but how widespread is it? And should we be careful of over-diagnosing gaming disorder so just because there's someone in your house who likes to play video games? You know, people like to play them. That's what they're there for. They're fun. They're going to capture you because that's what they're built for. But so do other things. TV, Netflix, all sorts of things are going to capture your attention. The number to call in is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Let's go back to the phones with James. And James, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thanks, David. I really enjoy your show. I listen all the time.
Well, thanks.
And I had a question and a comment. And so my comment is I can only think of three of my friends who are gamers, and two out of three are overweight and, you know, have some health issues. And so I just wanted to point that out. And then I wanted to ask you, is there any kind of research on people that play a lot of games and health issues, obesity problems, and things like that?
James, thank you for that call. So people, like we said before, like to fill in the blank, blame video games for one thing or another. And violence was one. We talked about that earlier. And now the obesity epidemic that we have in the United States, is there a connection? Dr. Kelly Dunlop, you want to try that first, and we'll go to Dr. Bean.
Well, I definitely don't think that there's a connection between video games and the obesity crisis, mostly because the obesity crisis existed long before we considered video games to be a mainstream thing that was common. For example, you know, two out of his three friends are overweight. If I remember my stats right, about 3/4 of American men are overweight just in general. So the stats would indicate that it is very likely that your friends or people you know are going to be overweight, whether they play video games or not. Video games are often sedentary and you sit down. But so, like you mentioned earlier, you know, so is television, and people don't seem to have an issue sitting down and watching, you know, 12 hours of football on a Sunday. So, and there are plenty of video games that are active, you know, the ones that are involve you, you know, getting up and dancing and moving around and physically interacting with your environment. And the idea that games themselves are sedentary, that is really only limited to video games. You know, what about board games? What about tabletop games? And if you want to get, you know, even more expansive, technically sports are games. So if we're going to say that games have a role in obesity, one, I think we need to be much more specific about what kind of games we're intentionally talking about. And two, looking a little bit more closely about the kind of stereotypes that we hold around people who play video games and comparing that to the actual baseline of the population of people who play.
But we are talking about electronic gaming. And yes, you can go play Pokemon Go and other augmented reality games on your smartphone that require getting out of your house and walking around and falling down manholes and things. But it's generally what people do, play games, and yeah, and then they may, or if they weren't doing that, they probably could be just watching TV. Dr. Bean, your reaction?
I'm kind of in the same camp, very, very much, just because of the obesity epidemic. It really, in my opinion, stems more from a sociological issue in the United States culture, where...
Well, this is a sociological thing that we're talking about.
Yes, this is true. But I do want to point out that if you go to other countries and other areas of the world, the United States is one of the few places that you can go to almost every corner and grab a McDonald's burger or grab a Wendy's shake. We live in a very unique place in this world for that obesity crisis. And I think that nutrition and diet in our country needs to be reeled in pretty heavily. As for the video games themselves, when we're having gamers who may be overweight and maybe genetically predispositioned to be overweight for some reason, and they, even no matter what they choose, whatever, or they try, they exercise and they still can't lose the weight, but they like video games because it makes them feel a little bit more sufficient and able to understand the world around them, makes them feel competent. We actually then incorporate, let's say if they're going to play Xbox and they're going to play Skyrim, on that on the TV, we actually incorporate movement within the game playing, such as while you play, you're walking on a treadmill, or you have a little bit of a mini bike pedals, and you're just pedaling as you're playing. And we actually see that just incorporating that little bit of exercise actually causes the weight to be lost to a degree, of course. Besides, and you have to change your diet around and things like that too. But I do think that to say that video gaming would be linked to obesity is kind of coming out of an erroneous area of the research.
All right. So let's go to Shane on the phones. Shane, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Just thank you for taking my call. I love the program. So my question was, at what point do we start to, a previous listener had mentioned the fact that her grandkids had used the tablets all the time and are obsessed with them. At what point do we start to shift blame towards parents, especially with young kids who start to show a problem with video games and tablet addiction? And what changes could parents make?
All right, Dr. Kelly Dunlop and Shane, thank you for that call. So these tablets have become electronic pacifiers, and are we, and brains, young brains are certainly vulnerable to these types of stimuli. Do we any research about that?
Oh, actually lots of research. So I will say, like, very openly, I am a mom and I have a 3-year-old and I love his tablet. I don't think of it as an electronic pacifier. That said, there is a lot of research by a researcher named Andrew Shabilsky and his partner Amy Orban, and they released an enormous study. I think it was last month, looking at like something like 10,000 people and their screen time use. And if I remember the statistic correctly, screen time use had the same negative mental health impact as a potato. So, you know, that research is out there.
I mean, if they sat there and looked at a potato for 3 hours versus looking at a tablet for 3 hours, is that what you mean?
I think it was more about the potential negative impact of eating a potato, which, okay. I know it seems ridiculous.
Yes, it does.
But then, like, science is ridiculous sometimes. That said, you know, I moderate what my son plays on his tablet. He loves his shape games. He loves his color games. He loves the games that read books to him. And I do think it's important to separate the idea of screen time versus games, because they are two completely different separate fields of study. But I don't have a problem with my 3-year-old using a tablet in moderation. And I really feel like that does transcend both screen time and video games, is that, you know, moderation is important, and anything done to excess is excessive.
Sure. Dr. Anthony Bean, really quickly, because I got a lot of calls here, can you talk about parental responsibility and making sure your kids are playing their games, electronic games, in an appropriate amount? Setting limits, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the biggest things that we do with here in down at the Telos Project is that we reinforce boundaries, such as if someone has the maturity level to handle a little bit more gaming, then they get a little bit more gaming. But we also always have what is the right amount for the family? What are they using it for? What is the parental responsibility? And what that comes down to is parents are there to raise their children, and they are there to help guide them through culture and through life. And if we rely on something else to do that just to keep them busy for the moment, it should bring up the question of what do we need to really do in this moment to help out our parents and do more better parenting tactics around screen time and video games.
All right, and let's go back to the phones with Christine. And Christine, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just have two quick points. As a parent, I definitely monitor my children's screen time. I'm trying to take a very balanced approach. I want them playing outside. I want them reading. And I've noticed when their friends come over, they want to go straight to the video games, but I feel that sort of hinders their social skills, because really through those social interactions, that's how kids are sharpening their social skills. And I feel like video gaming is a very sometimes solitary one-on-one thing. Now, as a teacher, I'm just wondering, is there any research that shows kids who are exposed to a lot of video gaming, and I'm not trying to put all of society's ills on video gaming. I think it can be challenging and fun. However, what I've noticed is a lot of my youngsters, I teach pre-K, they've already been exposed to games like Fortnite. And sometimes in the classroom, although I pride myself on having a very engaging and active classroom, sometimes like during story time or read alouds, the kids have to be able to sit still just for a little bit. And we always give them, I always give them brain breaks, but with the bright lights and video gaming is very engaging and it's very fast and it's very nonstop. It's just sometimes different than what you might see in a classroom. Not all the time, but in segments of our day. And I'm wondering, is there any research that shows any sort of negative correlation for kids who might not just be able to have that focus time because they're so stimulated?
Got it. Christine, thank you so much for that call. In 1 minute, Dr. Kelly Dunlap, can you tell us, is there any research about the shortening of attention span related to attention video games?
The research that is available has not found anything to suggest that video games are responsible for shortening attention span. And in fact, the research in that area has debunked the myth that our attention span is actually getting shorter. What it has found is that there are so many more demands on our times as human beings, from children all the way up to adults, just based on our lives as humans in a technological age, that makes it seem like attention spans are shorter. But really, it's just the amount of stuff that we have to do in a day versus our attention span being split that way.
All right. We're going to take another break. We'll be right back. Got some callers. We'll get them on the air. The number is 210-614-8980. Your questions about video gaming. What is an appropriate amount? When does it become too much? 210-614-8980. The Source continues right after this break. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. One of our most important commodities that each and one of us have is our time, and how we spend that time is going to end up in how we spent our life. So when you play a lot of video games, are you actually accomplishing something, or could that time be spent elsewhere, to better results? But also today in this culture, if you haven't been exposed to video games as a child, you're probably going to be the oddity in the classroom and have trouble communicating and being able to socialize with other kids. And as we're going to see a world where a lot more work is going to be done online, office work. We're going to be working remotely, being able to communicate and being able to know the norms, the social norms of being online is something that probably everyone's going to have to develop. So that's a skill that kids are coming up with as they play video games. So it's a complex question. It's really about balance and what is the appropriate balance for how much gaming is right for you and your family and your young ones. Let's go back to the phone lines, 210-614-8980 with Clark. And Clark, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I have a question. My wife is a stay-at-home housewife. She's not young. She's in her late 40s. She's diagnosed with social anxiety disorder. And so the majority of her interaction with other people is online through her games. She spends a lot of time, almost all day, playing video games. And I'm wondering, at what point do I need to be concerned that this is more than just her social interaction and might be borderline gaming addiction, and when I need to start to seek help?
Clark, thank you for your call. Let's go to Dr. Anthony, being a clinical psychologist and video game researcher. Your reaction?
So it all depends on what else is getting done. If the other house duties are getting done in conjunction with her gaming, then one would beg the question, is it really causing a distress in that moment, or is it really causing a problem? But if things are getting not done, such as every house person has a different set of duties. My wife and I share different ones. I wash dishes, she helps make dinner, and vice versa. We switch them off. So if those things aren't getting done and they're not getting done in the time that she's home, then I would probably say, ask the question of what's really kind of going on. But video games themselves also help with social anxiety on a lot of levels, and is a way for kids and adults to connect with others, to make them feel like they are part of something bigger and greater than themselves.
And Dr. Kelly Dunlop, if someone is addicted to something, and then you take away that something, and that individual has a reaction. They start jonesing, and they'll have, like, you know, they will do pretty much anything to bring that stimuli back into their life. Is that one way we can detect that there is a problem with someone with video gaming? If the system breaks down, or they lose electricity, or they can't play for an extended period of time, they have a meltdown, then you say, wow, we got a problem here.
I don't think so inherently. Mostly because if you take away, let's say, grandma's crossword puzzle when she's in the middle of it, she's probably going to be upset with you too. And so it's the idea of, if it's taken away, you would expect some kind of, you know, reaction in that capacity, because it's something they're enjoying, something they're putting effort and time into, and yoinking it, you know, would naturally make someone
Well, not
upset.
Doing it in a violent kind of way. It's like, give me that crossword, grandma, pay attention to me. No, but how about, like, if something happens and now you can't play your gaming and you're having trouble dealing with real life?
I mean, I think there's a certain range of emotion that you would expect. You know, if you lose something that you enjoy, it's okay to be sad. It's okay to be upset. It's okay to have those feelings. In psychology and working with clients, like, the line for us typically is it causing noticeable distress that is having a negative impact on other aspects of their life? So, for example, if the video game console goes down and someone decides, like, well, I'm just not going to go to work today because that has just ruined my entire life, that would probably be concerning to me, and I would want to ask them some more questions. But if, you know, I've had parents come up and just yank the power cord out of the wall to get their kids stop playing, and then they're surprised when their kids are upset and had that kind of reaction. And so it's a matter of degrees, and finding the difference between having something you really passionately enjoy taken away from you and something that you feel like you need to continue on.
Okay, so let's say little Johnny has been playing the game for 5 hours straight, and I'm the parent, and it's time for me to set limits. And I say, okay, Johnny, put down the game, and we're going to have dinner at the table like a family. And he says, no, Mom, get me a Pepsi. And so how do we deal with that?
Well, first, I'd want to know why little Timmy was playing for 5 hours straight. Like, I
because it's a great game. You know, he loves the game. That's his Jones. That's what he likes.
Yes, but does any parent let their child do something for 5 hours straight? And I'm putting out there as a hypothetical. I definitely do not want to engage in parent blaming. I think that's something that happens all too often. But my first question would be is, okay, if you have a young child and you are letting them play for 5 hours, I would want to have a conversation with the parent about setting boundaries.
Okay, so here's a parent who wants to set that boundary. Okay, I realize now I shouldn't have done it. I'm a bad parent, but I want to become a good parent.
Oh.
What do I do?
Well, throw those value judgments out the window first. But next, it can be really helpful with your kids, whether they're small, whether they're older. They need to know what's expected of them. And so if they know that they get 1 hour of gameplay, then that's the conversation you have up front. It's so much easier to address any kind of potential problem if you set those ground rules up front. So, you know, you need to do your homework first before you play your video games, or you need to stop playing your video game so you can come to the dinner table. And if there is difficulty in transition, as is common with smaller ones, like my three-year-old, like, that's just a normal part of being a toddler, is having difficulty in transition from task to task. There are things like giving warnings, like, okay, dinner's in 20 minutes, dinner's in 10 minutes, dinner's in 5 minutes, it's time for dinner. And that, you know, it's more appropriate for younger kids, but it's really effective because that allows somebody who's playing a game to get to a save point, to decide not to jump into a new quest. And there's ways that you can work with your child to find a solution that meets both of your wants and needs and makes everybody as happy as can be between parent and child.
Okay, let's go to another caller. This is Melissa. Hi, Melissa. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you for having this topic.
Okay, go ahead.
We have a son who is 33 years old. He started playing games when he was a teenager. We were living overseas at the time. We thought it would be good to occupy his time. But he became addicted, went away to college, delved into it really deep. Nobody was there to tell him to go to bed. And eventually he dropped out of college because he said it. He quit understanding what they were saying. And now he's, you know, this has been. He's not working. He's not pursuing an education and becomes violent whenever the I have to turn off the electricity to get him off the computer, and then he becomes very agitated, aggressive, verbally abusive. It's horrible, and we don't know what to do. We don't know how to help him.
Melissa, thank you for calling in. I'm sorry to hear about that. Well, I'm going to go back to Kelly Dunlop because this kind of adds to the conversation we were already having. So what would you tell Melissa?
I mean, that kind of behavior, whether it's games, whether it's, you know, whatever the person's engaging in, like, that behavior is not okay. I would have concern, especially if he's becoming aggressive, like finding help in whatever form that may take. I do want to throw it to Tony, though, because this reminds me a little bit of a case that he's worked with before. So I want to make sure that he speaks to this.
Dr. Anthony Bing.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the biggest things with behaviors in this capacity is when it gets to this point, we're looking at extremes. And when it hits the extremes, it means that we need to take extreme action with it as well. Because we don't want anyone else in the family to be hurt in any sort of rage or anything along those lines that could happen out of this. Now, when we look at this, if I was looking at this from a clinical standpoint, I would also want to know how long has this been going on, because once behaviors are ingrained at a 34-year-old age individual, we have to look at how long is it going to take to unwind these behaviors, because they've been so blaming. That's probably just because a lot easier to manage these things. But the 34-year-old also sounds like he definitely needs help with restabilizing a lot more of his other areas of life, such as getting in touch with the Texas Workforce Commission to get into some sort of job training program, or along the lines of rebalancing and structuring someone's life. But that also requires psychological help. And that requires someone who understands the games, the behavior manipulation, and if need be, psychological and diagnostic testing to understand what's really kind of going on. Is there something else going on? We don't know without kind of seeing what's the person in front of us and what's happening.
Right. So I think that's a really important point, that video gaming may, or probably not the problem. There are other problems. And this is an area where a person who is struggling can find some relief and some stability and some reward. And so they're going to be drawn to this. And had it not be video games, it would have been something else. And I don't want to make a picture where we're just trying to, you know, slag on video games all the time. This is, but a lot of people play games, and a lot of people play games very successfully. And I want to give Dr. Kelly Dunlop one quick word. You got like 20 seconds, please.
Oh, okay. No, I absolutely agree. It's easy to blame video games because they are so present. They are such a part of our culture. But it does take a question like, okay, well, what else is going on? And I think if we can get to that, asking like what's actually driving the behavior and how our games may be being the mediator between that, we'll be much better off.
And this is a learning process. This is a new technology. So thank you so much for our guest, Dr. Anthony Bean with the Telso Project, Dr. Kelly Dunlap. She is a researcher and designer at iThrive Games. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams. Direction provided by News Director Dan Katz. Technical assistance provided by Ruben Garcia. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.